But welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Friday's with Sandy Williams. And I don't know how it's possible, Sandy, that I can sound like I have a modicum of intelligence on Mondays and Fridays, but then Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, that disappears.
Oh, don't be hard on yourself.
But anyway, Sandy, I want to, and I've been talking about, off and on, about, you know, the student loans. But it's heating up now.
Yeah.
It's heating up, and I wanted to go into depth with you, because it's one thing to say, hey, we need to do something about the student loans and get it done, and as if that's an easy undertaking. And it's easy for Joe Biden and the pressure that he's under. Hey, you said you were going to do this for us, and you didn't, and so we're not going to vote for you. You know, if you don't do this, and he's almost backed into a corner. And then when he has now agreed to say,
well, I think his campaign promise was, or maybe it was imputed to him, was something like $50,000 of loan forgiveness or some such number. But, you know, the student loan forgiveness issue is filled with so many complex issues, equity issues. You know, right up to date, most of the forgiveness has been caused by some particular injustice or inequity. You know, the not-for-profit, the ITT school that collapsed and left people with the worthless diplomas.
Yeah, Donald Trump University.
Donald Trump, you know, those kind of things. And so that those were federally
forgiven. You can understand that, right.
You can understand how someone got duped and took out a student loan with good intentions and was duped by a now bankrupt entity, and how do you get rid of that problem? But to just forgive them across the board involves so many equity problems. Number one, the size of the student loan. Some people took out $300,000 to $400,000. People who graduate from medical school and had student loans through college and medical school and end up with $400,000
wow.
of debt. You know, that's a mountain to pay for. And then you have to ask yourself, well, could they pay it off? And maybe they can if they're neurosurgeons. Maybe they can't if they're nurse practitioners. I don't know. But then there are people who took out student loans because their parents, they had money, but the parents just decided that the kids ought to pay for it, or maybe the kids took out the loans to buy a car, and they were able to do that. There's just so many...
Room and board?
Room and board. Maybe the kid could have worked but didn't work, and they took out a student loan. Why did parents transfer to their children this obligation to pay for schooling when you're and my parents worked very hard, you know, expected us maybe to have a side job while we were in school, but they scraped to help us pay our way through school? And many kids now are being sent off to school by their parents with best wishes, and the parents witness the signature by the kid for the student loan. And so that's an inequity. Many student loans have been exploited by the universities. They've helped the children. They've helped their students, their incoming students, find out where and how they can borrow money so they can go to school. And the kids are eager to go to school. They're idealists. They aren't business people, and they decide they can afford to take on the debt. And in fact, they're getting counseled by the schools as to how much debt they can undertake. So that's a problem that has occurred. But all of these things don't leave the student who has the loan without fault. They have an obligation as well. So the question is, should we handle all these equity issues? Some of the people who have debt forgiven have now lots of money. Others who have debt forgiven or would have debt forgiven have no money and are doing public service jobs. There's just so many different circumstances to be considered that to have an across-the-board forgiveness of student debt has lots of equity problems associated with it. And if we forgive all the student debt, it's an enormous number. It's trillions of dollars.
You know, Sandy, you know, you graduated from Harvard, and the cost, and granted it was a few years ago, and that cost, as opposed to graduating from Harvard today, is it comparable, or has there been just a tremendous increase
Well, private schools have, I think, had increases in the price of tuition that is has exceeded the CPI, the Consumer Price Index rate of inflation, not by an enormous amount, but by a regular amount. It's a bit like the cost of medical care in our country, which has gone up faster than inflation by quite a bit, so that the percentage of the GDP that is spent on medical care now is a much greater percentage than it was in 1975. And the cost for education now to a private university or even a public university is a greater percentage of a family's average income today than it was in 1975. So, yes, it is more expensive. And some of that has been facilitated by this debt.
Yeah,
by debts, by student debt, because debt has put more money in the pocket of the consumer and has allowed the vendor, the universities, to increase tuition. So it's such a complicated issue. I think, does it deserve to be addressed in some fashion? Quite possibly, quite probably, because there certainly is a depressing effect on the economy and on some of the basic American institutions. Homeownership, for instance. Homeownership is being made much more difficult for young people who emerge into the job market and already have the equivalent debt hanging over their head of a mortgage, but they don't have a house. They
right.
simply have a debt that's looking in the rearview mirror that put them in the position to earn the income they're going to earn. So when and if they can buy a house is deferred materially out into the future. And so, you know, it is having an effect on society in America and the balance within our society. So, you know, should we be – I think we should be looking at a couple of things. I think we should be limiting the amount of student debt going forward. We should have a much more responsible approach to the amount of debt we would allow a student to incur. We should encourage families to get back to doing what they used to do, which is to push their children ahead of them and up above them, and to have going to college be a family enterprise and not just something that we foist onto the student.
You know, Sandy, is it safe to say, because I've heard many students and former students who've said we were taken advantage of. You know, we took out a loan that we really didn't understand. Well, we can all say that. The amount of time that as a young man, first time I bought a car, I was taken advantage of, you know.
Yes, but I think the federal government should have had a role, because the federal government was ultimately going to be holding a lot of these loans and guaranteeing a lot of loans. Had a role in possibly supervising the way in which universities, because you know universities have financial offices, and the financial offices sits down with a student
and they're going to make it happen for anybody.
Helps the student figure out how much loan they can undertake. And so you bought a car, but you didn't do it with the consultation and help of a counselor who was wearing something like a white jacket with the logo of
the university
on it, that was helping you understand why it is you could undertake this debt. My heart goes out to a lot of these people. I mean, some people undertook far too much debt and did it maybe for reasons that weren't altogether exemplary.
And they took the debt out for opportunities that are no longer there, trained in disciplines that aren't going to allow them to even make enough money.
Yeah.
You know.
One of the fallacies was that college education was there for the purpose of providing training for jobs. And in fact, you know, until 1965 or 70, it was quite clear that college wasn't there for that purpose. College was there for the purpose of expanding your intellect and helping you. That the belief was that when you were 18 and graduated from high school, you weren't done learning, you weren't done developing, you weren't done making yourself more valuable to society generally. And the job market out there had lots of training programs. So if you went to college and became this more valuable human being, the employer would take you under their wing and train you for for a year or two, because now you had proven your mettle as a human being of high capacity, and they would train you. Training on the job has gone out the window. Now college has become a place that people invest their money because of how much money it will make them in their career in the future. It's become this sort of hard-bitten financial analysis that is undertaken, which has that's been pushed in that direction by student loans.
But Sandy, there's been this change going back to when a college degree guaranteed you success in a society. In my lifetime.
Yeah.
And in your lifetime. That's what it was. But now, today, people are graduating all the time, more and more and more and more and more and more.
Yeah, go to less and less
opportunity.
You can go to a restaurant and ask your waiter or your wait person where they went to college. And most of them can tell you what degree they've already received. So, you know, I mean, it's
not funny, but
no, it's not funny. Yeah. I'm saying you're right. I'm just pointing out that people get jobs after college, but they don't get the job of their dreams.
You know, and the worst part about all of that is nobody's changing that. I mean, even as we speak now, people are still, the same thing is still happening.
Well,
and so at some point in time, we've got to go to a break for now. 844-967-2789 is the number. Sandy Williams is here. We'll be right back. So, the Earl Ingram Show, as always, you can join us at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. You can text us that same number. That's Friday. It means Fridays with Sandy Williams. You know, Sandy, there are parents right now and children right now. You remember this well. You know, graduation is right around the corner. And they're all excited. You know, Jimmy and Jane and all, everybody's getting ready and they're excited. And you know, used to watch, you know, the commercials and the things that they would be showing on television, especially when the students are getting ready to filling up Marquette University dorms and UWM and all of this, and they're all excited and they can play it over and over again. Thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people are coming, and they're all excited about a bright future. And I'll tell you something. I know some Marquette grads that you would automatically think, I'm like, you got a Marquette degree? And not that there's anything wrong with some of those things, but with the cost of a Marquette degree, you would almost think that somebody's going to be guaranteed a pretty rosy future, right?
Well, I mean, America doesn't guarantee futures, and our economy, has come around. Like I said, the standard
out
there.
But you pay all that extra money.
Yeah, we don't have training programs at workplaces, and workplaces are increasingly require that people come with resumes that prove they already know what they need to know in order to work there. So, you know, what's happened to most college graduates is they have to work as interns for little or no pay so that they can put on their resume.
And debt piles up.
And get trained. And meanwhile, they have student debt. And it's so that the time in which they start to earn the income to pay down their student debt gets deferred further into the future. And by the time they're ready to have a job that would permit them to pay it off, they have a wife or a husband and a child, and they've got a family. They may be looking for houses. I mean, the world closes in on people much more rapidly than a 18-year-old or 19-year-old student expects. It will. And so that's part of this problem. I mean, I was saying off the record, I think that the student loan problem is another symptom of how it is that America, unlike the developed nations of Europe, have failed to provide the robust kind of infrastructure for their people that permits a capitalist economy to thrive. We've taken capitalism to the point of saying that every citizen lives their life in every respect under the rules of laissez-faire, you know, which is, you know, the standard of caveat emptor, the marketplace prevails. Make your choices and either achieve success or achieve failure based on your own personal choice. And that's what we've done to people about healthcare. And healthcare has become enormously expensive and unavailable to many, many people in this country. That's what we've done about education. That's what we've done about childcare. Well, let's just take education, for instance. In countries like Germany, France, others, England, you can go to public universities there as long as you can qualify to go there. You will have the government pay for your education so that you don't graduate with debt at all. You graduate as a qualified human being, qualified based on the university standards, and you emerge into the economy ready to work and ready to participate in the economy, to buy a home if you can afford it. Now, this might affect the taxes that are required for that, might to some extent affect the net income you earn. But if you look at families' expenses. If you take a family in Germany and you say you don't have to save money for education, you don't have to save money for child daycare, you don't have to save money for the health care that you would otherwise require. So what do you need money for? You need money for housing, you need money for discretionary expenditures, food, you need money for holiday. And so that those workers can go to work unburdened by these other concerns. Are they still hungry to make income? Of course they are. Are they, you know, those things that I've talked about are necessities. In America, people live without those necessities and they don't do it because it improves their life to have the money. They do it because it puts them in fear, but they don't have the money to spend on those things and to participate in our economy in any fruitful way. You know, several weeks ago, I took a family and suggested they had $60,000 of income, and can you make it?
Yeah.
And in the American economy, where you have to pay for your own child daycare, you have to pay for your own children's education, you have to pay for your own health care, $60,000 gets eroded after a modest amount of federal and state income taxes down to a subsistence wage. And so that tells me that we've got an economy that's failed to put the underpinnings in it that permit people to live at, you know, relatively satisfactory wages, because we've burdened them with all these other things. And student loans are a significant part of that burden, and we need to modify it. Now, we need to modify, you know, if we don't unbreak this system, if we don't create this kind of an underpinning for our economy, we're going to break our market-based capitalist system. We're going to break our society, and the whole thing's going to fail.
So that middle age, I mean the
middle class
living that we have talked about, that is fleeting. College used to be a harbinger and would help, and people would automatically wind up in that middle class. Now people with college degrees are not living in that middle class.
Well, they might live in a middle class, but the middle class is so pinched. You know, the middle class, when we were getting out of school, you went and got a job, and it included health care.
Right.
And the public university was going to be available at a very modest cost, and so you didn't have to save a lot for your child's
right.
education if they were going to go to public university. And so it was different. And all of that was accommodated with single household wage earner, with someone
right.
else staying at home. So the families didn't have to worry about child daycare costs. They didn't have to worry about health care costs. And education was not hanging over their head in the same manner. Take a family today, and they not only have to save for their child's education, but they have to pay back their student loan. They have to have two income earners in the household. If they earn $60,000 a year, the wife better work too in order to live in a middle class America.
So
we've changed the whole profile of what it means to live in America. And the reason it's changed is because we don't have this social safety net.
So, Sandy, if a parent was listening right now and their child is graduating in May or June, and, you know, you and your wife had to sit down with your children, and they're wondering, should I do this? Should I not do that? They're going to have probably think about things a whole lot more than when you and I were.
Oh, they are. I mean, I coach Milwaukee Rowing Club, and one of our best young rowers, a great kid, highly qualified kid, is going off to a Eastern public university, and how could he afford it? Well, he's joining the National Guard, and the government is paying for it, but he's going to pay it back by being exposed to the military for 5 or 6 years after he gets out. I said, well, you know, let's pray there isn't a war during that time period, but, you know, I'm great to hear it. And lots of kids are now doing lots of serious thinking about where they go to school and what school's going to get for them and how much it's going to cost. And parents are continuing to shift a fair amount of burden to their kids.
All right. Listen, we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. It's Friday. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams. Sandy, before we go to, you know, the Elon Musk and
Twitter?
Yeah, I was going to say TikTok.
Oh.
You're getting there. It's not Facebook.
It's Twitter, Earl.
Oh, it's Twitter. So, Sandy, you know the difference between TikTok and Twitter and all that.
I do.
I don't, man. I just... Are you on TikTok or any of those things? No, come on. You're not. You can't be a TikTok.
Have I looked at them? Sure, TikTok has got some interesting, you know, they've got amusing things on TikTok.
I've seen your dance videos out there, Sandy. No, I'm kidding.
I'm not on TikTok, no.
So you know, Facebook, I'm on Parler, by the way.
Parler.
That's a conservative site that they created a year ago because they thought that Facebook was preventing them from saying and doing whatever it is they wanted to, the Trumpites.
Ah.
So I wanted to see what was Parler. So I
Parler. Like a funeral parlor.
Yeah, that's what my wife corrects me. A funeral. So it's Parler.
Yeah.
So I have one of those. And I don't think I ever followed up on it. I just, at the time that conservatives were all running over there, I decided just to see what was being said. And my.
Outlandish.
Yeah, to say the least.
Yeah.
And I guess that's where it gets to, Sandy, where people say, and there's freedom of speech.
Well, you know, we were talking about this off the air a little bit. I think what you have to do is you have to look at freedom of speech. And freedom of speech, for instance, allows someone to put down a soapbox in Central Park, stand up on top of it, and say anything.
Right.
Okay? And they're free to say anything, and they can try and get a crowd around them, and they can try and affect the opinion of that crowd around them. And you can do this any place. I could go out on the corner right out here and start telling people and talking to people and telling them things. And, you know, if I don't, you know, the freedom of speech is broad. Now, the issue developed when we had these large social media like Facebook, where it became apparent that what someone said on Facebook was readily available to millions of people, and those millions of people, by repeating it, created something that was different than the repetition of someone repeating something that someone said in Central Park. The ability to spread that to millions of people was not immediate and was not even possible. So the impact of these platforms was different than what the freedom of speech concept was built around. And so as 2016 comes along and there's a belief that Facebook was exploited during the campaign by people who wanted to bend public opinion, and they did it with half-truths and non-truths and conspiracy theories and what have you. And so there was a hue and cry like, hey, we've got to do something about this. But doing something about it is a very hairy kind of a concept. If you believe in the freedom of speech and you're an American Civil Liberties Union kind of a person, can you really restrict what's said on a platform simply because it's said to so many people? It would be like restricting what's said on television, right? Television can be said to millions of people. And, you know, the FCC did have certain kinds of restrictions on what could be said on television. But the pattern of speech, the content of the speech was pretty free and open. So it's a very hairy problem. It's not one that's easy to digest. And some people are asking, well, if Elon Musk gets Twitter, is this platform, this one in which 242 letters or whatever it is that are allowed to be used in a tweet, can be the content of it, can it be restricted? And, you know, there has been a hue and cry, and there was about, for instance, Donald Trump, who was banned from Twitter,
right,
based on the notion that he was using Twitter to be misleading or otherwise falling out of bounds of the rules for the bulletin board, which is what it is. It's a bulletin board where people can put up little short post-it notes that they want people to read. I think of Twitter as a site for post-it notes, and what can you put on the post-it note? So it isn't very hard to create a platform, at least not technologically. And if Elon Musk decides to impose restrictions on his on the Twitter that he now owns personally that become unpopular or unsatisfactory, somebody can set up a competitor. So he does have competition to police him. And since it isn't run by the government, it isn't subject to the same freedom of speech concepts that the government is subject to. That, you know, the government has to support and cannot restrict free speech. But you can tell me what to say on the radio. You, Earl, can. I'm on your show, and you can restrict what I say on your show. I don't have freedom of speech in that regard. But the government can't impose any restrictions on us. And so that's where it gets hairy with these.
But the FCC, which is the government,
yes,
can.
Well, the FCC has very limited extent to which it can. It can police the obscenities that we might use, and not a lot else.
Not content. You know, is it much ado about nothing? I mean, this conversation. You know, the answer is always not to stifle speech, but to have more free speech. So let's say if you've got a hate group who is, you know, hiding out and using the platform.
Yeah.
The answer is create an anti-hate group to debate the hate group.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not troubled by Facebook itself deciding to police its bulletin board. It would be as if the Lutheran Church has a bulletin board out in front of it, and it comes out and it finds that some neo-Nazi group has decided to stick things up on that bulletin board.
Right.
Well, they're free to take that stuff down. It's not a government bulletin board. It's not one that is open to the public to use. It's the Lutheran Church's bulletin board. And same with Facebook. Facebook is not, I mean, until the government would decide that they're a common carrier for information, Facebook is free to police itself and what it says. Similarly, Fox News is free to police itself in terms of what it decides to put on the show, right? Same with MSNBC. And so it's just when we get into the government playing in the game of what should be permitted speech, we're just into a hairy question.
Because in the long run, people...
Or permitted or required speech. Right. Okay. Should a church be required to allow everyone to say anything they want? Well, no. Should a school be allowed, be required to? Well, is it a public or private school? Now we get a different question.
So is it then that people are, you know, whatever that post-it thing that you are talking about, fictional post-it thing, it's either you, if you like it, fine. If you don't, you don't have to read it. Is that?
Well, that's sure. I mean, that has to do with whether you should care about what's posted on Twitter.
Right.
But we were talking about should we care about what Twitter allows to be right. posted on Twitter? Because Twitter might, under one man's rule, he might decide what kind of content he wants to allow on Twitter. So maybe that means that some other, you know, I don't know what it would call itself, linker. Something else would come up to, you know, if he starts imposing too much restriction, you'll end up with some version of Parler, you know, or whatever it is that needs to be set up by some group that feels offended by the restrictions. So I just think speech and free speech is a government issue. And when you get into private media, then what's required to be allowed as speech or what's restricted as speech is a matter of public taste and it's a matter of the marketplace.
So, Sandy, let's get into this. And actually, it's the real reason Congress gets nothing done. You got any ideas of the real reason why?
Yeah, it's because we talk about this kind of stuff. It's because they get all wound up in their socks about the LGBTQ kinds of issues and things that people have little or no business spending all their time thinking about.
Yeah.
And we have much more interest and need to spend our time thinking about really important things. And to be honest with you, it has a little bit to do with things like Ukraine, which take all of our attention away from making America a better place to live.
So this is Robert Reich, and his question is, why doesn't Congress get anything done? And his response is, well, one chamber actually does. Hundreds of bills have been passed by the House of Representatives, but have been blocked from ever getting a vote in the Senate. Bills like the Freedom to Vote Act, the John R. Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, the Equality Act, background checks for gun sales, reauthorizing the Violence Against Women Act, the Protecting the Rights to Organize Act, the Build Back Better Act, the list goes on and on and on. So why aren't these crucial bills getting a vote in the Senate?
Well, I mean, the Senate has these rules. It has the cloture rule that requires 60 votes, not 50 votes, to get something passed. And so that it makes it a clog right there. And the whole intention of that is to make it harder and less possible to pass lots of changes, right? So it's kind of a status quo protection rule. And that's a problem. Another thing
AKA
is that,
the filibuster.
Yeah, the filibuster. It basically the 60 vote thing was set up so that people didn't actually have to bother to stand up and bore the rest of their fellow senators by talking endlessly. They would simply say that essentially I'm going to filibuster, and they well, you don't need a filibuster. We'll just make a 60 vote requirement for this bill. The other thing is that it is a bit easier to pass a bill that you know isn't going to pass ultimately, so you can pass things that are done declaratively.
And it says, look, we are doing something the House perspective.
Yeah, but I mean, a lot of those things are very meaningful and could be important things to pass. But why is it that the Senate is allowed to tie things up that way? And I think it has a lot to do with the American public's willingness to focus on everything but the stuff that really matters.
We've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. It's Fridays. That means Sandy Williams is in the studio. We'll be back.
Yeah.
stories. You can join us at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Fridays. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams. You know, Sandy, you know, I was reading this article by Robert Reich, and he was explaining why we just can't get anything done. You know, he said the House passed over 200 bills since the start of 2021, and yet just a small percentage of any of those bills have been able to be passed into law. And so it often frustrates the everyday person why we can't get any of these things accomplished, any of these things done. It's almost an impossible undertaking. But if the House can get it done and Democrats and Republicans can work together on a House level, you just, and they have differences, but what makes it so doggone hard to get the Democrats and the Republicans on the Senate? Different laws? Different rules? Well, different rules of engagement?
Yeah, different rules of engagement. You know, the so-called cloture, which is, you know, in the Senate you're allowed to filibuster, which means you can talk, stand up and debate forever, and essentially...
Yeah, the green eggs and ham thing with...
yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you stand up and talk and you end up deferring the consideration of bills so long that the people who want to put it up decide that they're not going to waste... They don't want to waste the Senate's time. They've got something else more important they want to pass, or they get pushed into compromise. And so that used to be the case, and the Senate got so sick of filibustering with some of the people who were so good at doing it, many of them Southern senators, that they decided to adopt a different standard, which was if someone basically says they're going to filibuster, we'll adopt a 60-vote, because it took 60 votes to sit the person down and make them stop the filibuster. So they decided to adopt a 60-vote requirement to pass a bill that might otherwise be filibustered. And, of course, there was always somebody there to say, well, I might filibuster this bill. So basically there's a 60-vote requirement for bills. And that makes it hard to pass things in the Senate. And, you know, it also... Passage in the Senate is ultimate passage of a bill. So there's a great deal of focus of all the interest groups at the Senate level. When a bill passes the House, it's a much bigger body. It's harder to lobby. It's harder for people of interest groups to put all their pressure on the caucus. Because, you know, when you have the caucus is all the people of the same party. And so the Democratic caucus in the House of Representatives controls the House numerically. They meet, they decide things they'd like to pass, they take a vote within the caucus to find out how they feel about it, and then they take it out on the floor, and things tend to pass, many of them, on party votes. But they know that all the pressure and all the interest focused on it will happen in the Senate.
You know, Sandy, you were talking earlier about how, you know, we need to change things in the country. And yeah, I think we all agree that we need to change things in the country. But we can't change things in the country until...
Well, some of these things, I mean, it doesn't happen quite this way in multi-party parliamentary countries, because instead of having two-party caucuses, there'd be five-party caucuses, and they all go off and have their own conversations. And to get a bill passed primarily requires a coalition between several of those caucuses to reach agreement on something. And they're much more committed, it seems, to actually getting things accomplished in those countries. And it's harder for one side to have a blackball, because typically you can form a coalition. If you can't form it, if the centrists can't form it with the Green Party and the Conservative Party, they can form it with whatever. You know, they can come up with different combinations. And so the interest groups don't have as much leverage.
You know, you the interest groups and all of these things, and no matter how hard you try, you know, and I'm watching, and it's the same thing over and over. And the American people get frustrated, and, you know, and I talk to people who basically give up on things because they say nothing's ever going to change for us. And that's kind of where we are headed. It's one of the reasons why there's a lack of people who are willing to vote. because they don't even feel like they're part of any of this.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at what tends to make people vote, it isn't the stuff that creates substantive things in America that are different, that are other than the social issues, which seem to be at the top of political activity. So we tend to get a fair amount of things accomplished. You know, states around the country are busily focusing lots of attention on abortion availability.
Yeah.
And making abortion, again, a very primary issue in states in which education and public welfare are seriously at risk. But do they talk about those things? No, because it's much easier to grab everyone's attention to talk about abortion access.
Sam, who do we have online?
Tom from L.A. is calling.
Hey, Tom, what's going on, man? How you doing?
Hey, Earl. First off, we the people are the government, and we must never forget that. And I am a proud FDR Democrat. Sandy, first off, I would like to reframe what it is that you're saying, because I think that termination of a pregnancy is much more than what it is that it actually is. It's either a woman's choice or the government's choice in terms of what this whole issue is about. Many women do not terminate a pregnancy, but it is her choice. And the thing is, if we're going down that rabbit hole of women losing choices, then let's go back to the 1950s and 60s, where a woman had to ask her husband if he could have money in his checking, or if she could have a checking account even opened in her name. So there's a lot more to this whole thing than just, termination of a pregnancy. It's about the government controlling women, not only with their reproductive rights, but also a lot more.
Hey, Tom.
Tom, I didn't mean to diminish the importance of women's rights and the notion that the government.
No, I know that, but we.
Yeah, no, and I agree with you. I agree that it's.
We call it abortion rights. It's not abortion. It's a woman's right to choose, because there's a hell of a lot of women. 80% of the women that actually choose to carry a child to term.
I don't disagree.
We fall into that narrative of like we're the pro-death party. You know what I mean? Because we all know what the opposite of pro-life is. It's pro-death, and that's not the way that this is. It's either a woman's right to choose, which is the noun, a woman, or it's got to be pro someone else's.
Yeah. Well, I think I was talking about abortion access, but I don't disagree that the issue is far different than that. It really is a woman's right. And what's interesting to me is the same people who want to make sure that the government intervenes in terms of a woman's right to the medical treatment of abortion wants to make sure that the government doesn't intervene and require someone to have a vaccination, which is so the woman is required. So the woman is required.
Or they don't like it when. I'm sorry.
Go ahead quickly, Tom.
Or they don't like it when the government's telling them to choose control their guns.
Right.
So.
I agree.
It's funny that they allow that.
Yeah.
But I wanted to also say part of the problem, of course, as we all know, is money and politics. I think that when you got these senators and congresspeople spending 80% of their daytime trying to figure out a way to make money so they can actually run for office and dial for dollars all day long, that is a huge, huge problem, because they should be spending that time legislating and talking about the issues rather than just dialing for dollars.
Hey, Tom, we got to go. We got to go to the break. Thank you very much for the call. 844-967-2789 is the number. Sandy, you can respond on the other side. We'll be right back.